From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue to examine the question of whether or not the presidency of Donald Trump has been derailed by his opponents, and if he is now operating on behalf of the swamp that he said he was running against. For more on that, we speak with Professor Tony Montero, the organizer and political scientist from Philadelphia, who is a regular contributor here at CPR. Let's start, I guess, with this editorial in the New York Times today, Wednesday, about Trump more or less being brought to heel, I guess.
This is just the most recent one on the editorial pages of the New York Times, but it's significant because it starts by saying President Trump's populist anti-trade deal rhetoric was always hard to believe coming from someone who outsources clothing manufacturing to China. Now it's becoming clear that he has no coherent plan to lower trade deficits or bring back lost manufacturing jobs. And they continue with a celebration of the fact that he has been brought to heel, that it looks like while he campaigned against NAFTA as the worst trade deal ever, he is not going to do very much to change it. When you put this alongside of their celebration, everything from Fareed Zakariyev to, again, the editorial pages and opinion pages of the New York Times celebrating his bombing of Syria and Afghanistan and stepping up the war in Yemen. And when you combine that with the fact that suddenly, and quote, miraculously, Russiagate has disappeared from the pages of the Washington Post and New York Times and CNN. And suddenly, Mr. Trump, who was being portrayed as the most incompetent person to ever sit in the Oval Office, is now being praised by these very same people as presidential. So this is a great lesson in the workings of power in the United States and, frankly, where power actually exists. You know, I had made the statement in interviews and in discussions with you a number of times that fascists don't have to run for office in the United States, that they're already embedded in the deep state, and that that is where power is. And so it's not a question of them taking power. They already have it. And what we have seen transpire over the last few weeks, to me, indicates and is a lesson for the American people and the American left of where power actually resides, and in fact, what the struggle is all about.
So many things have been exposed in the last couple of years. A lot of it in the course of last year's presidential election, much of it in direct response to the lifting up, in any event, of the candidacies of both Trump and Sanders, something that scared the hell out of the establishment. Oh, yeah. And you saw them smothering it. They were lifting Clinton above all else, wall to wall, like we have never seen. So here we are. We've learned a lot. Let's maybe take a look across the landscape at at what we have learned about our institutions and about ourselves thus far.
Oh yeah, and that's the real thing. What can be learned from this moment? And we say that recognizing that among the infantile left, it is this, we told you so, as they sat in their armchairs and at their computers typing their analysis into social media. The fact of the matter is this is a learning moment, not just for us, but for the American people. And what it shows is that the real power in this country does not reside with the presidency. The Sanders and Trump movements were grassroots movements that sent a profound message to the powerful about the depth and breadth of the anxiety and anger of the American people. There was a partial victory with the defeat of Hillary Clinton and the neocon and neoliberal globalist forces, the party of war, as it were. But it was temporary because and I put quotes, the resistance, as it named itself, along with the deep state, the CIA, the corporate elite, the corporate media, the CIA, and on and on and on, hammered Trump into submission. And that's what it was. And I would say that at this point, the Trump presidency is no more. And I would consider it a coup d'etat without removing the object of the coup. Now the forces of the deep state of war are back in power. Now, the other side of it is that it is very apparent that Trump, in putting together an administration, thought that he could do virtually the impossible, and that is to have Flynn and Bannon representing his views while they would be in some kind of uneasy coalition with known war hawks. And again, Mattis was one of them, but Flynn was taken out early. Bannon was sidelined. Tillerson, who we didn't know where he stood, we thought he would be, and he could have been different, and he might be, we don't know yet, but he has been brought to heel. And at this point, the Trump administration looks pretty much like what Clinton, a Clinton administration would have looked like in terms of war and peace. So it is a tutorial in the nature of power in the United States at this time, and that in effect, we do not have a working democracy any longer. That here we see the deep state and the real centers of power enforcing their will upon a popularly elected president. We could go into more of that. I mean, you know, from the very beginning, as you will well remember, right after the election, they were talking about impeachment. They were talking about deploying or employing the 25th Amendment, that he was crazy, and so on and so forth. And he had even gone so far in respectable journals like Foreign Policy and the New York Times to call either for his assassination or for a military coup d'etat. This was from even before he was inaugurated. So the pressure was tremendous to make sure that he did not even attempt to carry out any of the things that he promised his voters during the 2016 election.
You know, I mean, let's take a look. I might have characterized it differently, the question of whether or not we have lost a democracy that I'm not sure we ever had. But
yeah, right,
certainly
right.
We could say at least the veneer of democracy has been ripped, you know, ripped away. If you have the myth of the independent elected politician, someone who, in this case, And it's, it was a popular myth in our political culture that was Ross Perot, for example, Nelson Rockefeller, FDR even, in particular, that they were wealthy enough to not have to be beholden to other rich people. And so they could go in, you know, and if they were altruistically inclined, they had the space to do that. And in any event, that they could be independent regardless of what their intent was. And Trump is, you know, the modern-day version of that, certainly.
Yes.
He's wealthier going into it than any of them usually are. He went in on top of a popular movement in a context of complete loss of confidence in the structures of society, you know, a crisis of confidence in all of the institutions. And so you would think that those were the optimum conditions for somebody that wanted to come in and make change. And he did promise, as you pointed out, a considerable personal political expense, some major changes in foreign policy. And here we are, that even someone in that position, and as bullheaded and as tone deaf as Trump has been painted, is not outside of the grip of these people once they decide to make a play.
That's right. And once they make their threats that of what they would do if you do not come to heel. Oh, yes. And you know, Don, it happened so quickly, a matter of hours.
Yeah, he, 2 days, right?
It was no, it wasn't days. It was a matter of hours. Recall, he was saying one thing 48 hours earlier, the exact opposite.
Right, so sometime inside that 48 hours.
Yeah. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. But that is what power looks like in this country. And you know, the whole movement, which self-defined as the resistance, was always a movement financed, organized, promoted, directed by non-governmental organizations, big money, and the deep state. With an appearance or veneer of being progressive and left, and of course the infantile and what you also call the senile left,
right.
you know, were there only for window dressing. And as we had discussed many, many times, the so-called radical left was really not a left after all. It was, these were more protest organizations who had no strategic vision or understanding of what was at stake and the way the game was being developed at this time. And I think, and I don't like to quote myself, but I do remember saying not that long ago, I think it was in an interview with you, that the real battle was between the people and the deep state.
Yep.
It was not the people versus Trump. It was the people versus the deep state. And that the highest stakes were those of war and peace. And that this thing with Russia was not just a political ploy being employed by the Democratic, the Hillary Clinton people in the Democratic Party. In fact, the stakes were very high because the neocons do want a war or some sort of confrontation with Russia. They still do. I think that this is not just a learning moment for the broad masses of people, many of whom were sucked into this so-called resistance, but it should be a learning moment for what is called the radical or socialist and sometimes communist left. They had it wrong. They were deeply wrong. They did not understand that this was not about the two parties per se. It was about the people versus the deep state. The people had made their will known. They had made their their sentiments felt throughout 2016. And that is why we always saw these two movements as movements from below, the Trump movement and the Bernie Sanders movement. Bernie Sanders betrayed his movement earlier and continues to do so in an attempt to resolve the deep crisis in the Democratic Party, which they will not resolve. The question is, can the party continue to exist? Well, Trump held out a little bit longer, but he has been brought to heel. And now the people are left to find their way through this morass of contradictions.
Now, looking at the foreign policy side of that and the... I don't know, the change in direction. Certainly, the thing that's presenting itself, which is outside of the range of foreign policy conditions we were promised specifically by Trump's campaign, where we have, we're shooting flares at Iranian vessels in the Persian Gulf. Let me say that again. Iranian vessels in the Persian Gulf, not Iranian vessels in Long Island Sound. Okay, mm-hmm. we're shooting at them for getting too close to us. And we are, you know, sending an armada. Well, no, we're not. It's actually going to Hawaii for a few drinks. But oh, it's going to North Korea again, et cetera. Mm-hmm. People are in the streets in South Korea because they feel and can taste a palpable taste of warfare on their peninsula. Mm-hmm. This rhetoric with Russia, which has been dropped for the moment, New York Times, Washington Post and such, mm-hmm. CNN, but they're cooking it still. Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough were stoking it up on MSNBC some, and also it's getting some play on Fox, which is an interesting thing, too. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of hot spots going on and a lot of pushing and shoving and chest thumping.
Right. Yes, and, it is. Know, yes, and, you know, we can't, I mean, and you put into the picture that you're describing the French elections.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that Mélenchon, the press paints him, the far left candidate, the communist candidate, as it were, has not declared his support for either Le Pen or Macron, which suggests that he will let his voters, which were close to 20%, decide who they will vote for. And he has defined this election himself very much in the way that Le Pen has, as between the globalist, the neoliberal globalist, and those who are beholden to the EU and Angela Merkel, that is the German finance capital, versus the people of France. I mean, the architecture is very similar to what went on here in 2016, the neoliberal globalists, and in our case, the war makers versus the people. That was what Brexit, in a lot of ways, was about. And some interesting things going on in France. I mean, this is why the labels left and right don't really fit. Le Pen has said that she would welcome Julian Assange and Edward Snowden to live in France and provide them safety there. I mean, this is huge, as well as she has argued that she'd make it a referendum about pulling out of NATO, and as the bourgeois press puts it, she admires Putin, which means she does not support the push to war with Russia.
Right.
This is not just an American or Trump phenomena. That's why the so-called resistance was such a joke and a fraud.
And here's the same thing with Mélenchon. he's playing Sanders now. First, he says, mm-hmm. I'm going to poll my supporters to see who, and it sounds like the way it was phrased, to see who they'll support. But then it says ab initio, and it says, you know, a priori, says that none of our members will vote for Le Pen. And so we're going to poll our members on three choices. One is a blank vote, two is to vote for Macron, and three is to abstain. I'm unclear on the political distinction between a blank vote and an abstain, other than the mechanical process of dropping a blank ballot in or just not bothering. But Le Pen's, it's the same thing that they did with Sanders people with Trump, and they tried to do. That, you know, Trump was unmentionable. It was going to be either hold your nose and vote for Clinton or vote for Stein or Johnson, if that's what you have to do, you know, and that was the way they read it. And in fact, what we learned was that a lot of those people that voted, that were supporting Sanders, voted for Trump in key places. And
yeah, except in the French election, it's a little bit different because, you know, it's two tiers, and the top four candidates were only separated by a few points.
And only one of them is a real embrace the EU candidate.
That's right.
Macron. And the others, I mean, you've got both Le Pen and Mélenchon. They were both, let's get out of the EU. And
that's absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's important because, you see, and this is where the normal politics of polling and predicting and all of that stuff doesn't work, because no one knows for sure what the voters are going to do. Mélenchon was not even anywhere near being significant a few weeks ago. And suddenly he explodes on the scene based on one thing. Anti-EU, anti-NATO, anti-globalization, you know. So his voters are not waiting upon him necessarily to tell them what to do, in the same way that the Sanders voters made decisions which went against what Sanders said, at least a good part of them. And it's very interesting. It broke very much in the way that even Mélenchon is suggesting the choices for his voters. You know, most of them went with Hillary Clinton. A good part of them, and we don't really know the percentage, went with Trump. Some of them went with Stein, and a lot of them didn't vote. They abstained. And I think this pattern of opposition to globalization, and the fact that social movements have the potentiality of rising out of these elections. You know, again, and I just want to go back. That's why the resistance was a fraud. The resistance was a fraud because it blocked the mushrooming of a social movement around the issues of peace, war and peace, anti-globalization, against TPP, and a renegotiation of NAFTA. That never got off the ground because they smothered the potentiality of exploring modes of coalition at the grassroots level. That is, between the Sanders people, the Trump people, the disenchanted Democrats, and so on. But now, here's what we're looking at. A real resistance is possible at this time. And quite ironically, it will be that coalition of people under the Trump banner, some of them defined as white nationalists and alt-right, and people under the Sanders banner. And all of those who have a genuine interest in social justice and peace. I think we're on the cusp of something real big. There's going to be a moment, a deep moment of confusion and disarray, you know, with Steve Bannon probably going to have to leave the White House and his people saying through social media and talk radio that Trump was not elected to do what he's doing now, that he has bowed down to the neocons and to the Washington establishment. And they're seeking new ways of real resistance. And I think that's the same for the Sanders people. If I look at the black community, And again, I'm most familiar with Philadelphia. The abstaining from voting in November was a judgment upon the Democratic Party and, in particular, the black misleadership class. I think those voters are out there. They're ready to be mobilized. They don't want war. They want a trillion-dollar infrastructure policy, which it doesn't look like we're going to get. And these people want jobs. They want, you know, they want peace, they want jobs, and they want social justice. And that's not in the cards at the level of government.
And finally, it's going to be very interesting. You know, we've been calling out for a year or better the ready alliance of the left and the anti-war movement with, you know, the most reactionary forces ever to govern in this country in many ways, so particularly on the, if you look at the world stage where it's headed and domestically where it's headed. You know, the last administration prosecuting people under the Espionage Act for right. whistleblowing, things, you know, all, on all fronts, really. A willingness, you know, for the left, you know, on the part of the left and the anti-war movement, and so-called in each case, you know, to work with those forces. Now right. that you're going to see Bannon and other so-called alt-right people talking about taking Trump down or punishing him or motivating him or whatever based on the things that he promised that the left should have embraced.
Absolutely.
No more regime change, no war with Russia, an end to nation building and the neocon mm-hmm. project and neoliberal mm-hmm. economics, because mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. was all in his message. Will they be willing to make common cause? Will the left and the anti-war movement be willing to make common cause with this other sector of the working class that's making mm-hmm. working class demands?
Right. Well,
if you can hang with the CIA, can you hang with an unemployed CWA worker?
Right, right, right. This is the big question. And this was the frustration over these last few months, you know, when we saw, and it seemed to be quite apparent to the two of us, that a moment, this was a moment, you know, in war and peace and jobs creation at home. This was a moment. Mm. You opposed Trump where he had to be opposed.
Right.
But you supported him where he could be supported. It's what is known as critical support.
I got to say that you brought me to that point, by the way. There was just some step I hadn't taken in understanding the historical moment that we were living in, and you pointed me to the fact that you had movements, and that movements are what drive history, not politicians. Yeah. It reminded me of that.
And you know, people underestimate how widespread poverty and suffering and joblessness is in this country.
That's right.
It's not just the miners in West Virginia. It's the manufacturing workers in the Midwest. I mean, Cleveland of today is not Cleveland of 30 years ago.
Hey, walk around any city that this broadcast is being heard on. Go walk a couple of blocks and find out how many people are either in foreclosure or eviction.
Yes.
Alone, yes. Anywhere in the country.
Yes. And of course, the crisis of white privilege, which is forcing masses of working class white people, if not to fundamentally change their worldview, at least to begin to question some things.
Right.
And that's what we saw with the Trump thing. They responded to no intervention wars, peace with Russia, and jobs at home, and an end to the neoliberal globalist policies.
We'll have the second and final part of that conversation with Professor Tony Montero tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.